Welcome to another episode of the Dose of Leadership podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and educational interviews with today's most relevant and motivating leaders. Each episode is dedicated to highlight real-life leadership and influence experts who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the truth, common sense, and courageous leadership. And now, here's your host, Richard Ryerson.
Hey, welcome to the show. Happy as always you're tuning into Dose of Leadership. Kate Eberle Walker is on the show today. She is the CEO of Presence Learning. It's the leading provider of online special ed services for K-12 schools. In this role, she leads a majority female employee population in their mission to provide a flexible career path for over 1,000 special ed therapists, most of whom are working mothers. She worked her way up to become CEO of the Princeton Review in 2015 at the age of 39. And while CEO, she not only made the business profitable, she did so while building a 50% female executive team, having tasked herself with the goal of making her C-suite fully aligned with the gender balance of the organization as a whole. What I love about Kate is she offers this kind of straight, tell-it-like-it-is advice to everyone, particularly fellow CEOs, especially men, and she serves as a behind-the-scenes advisor to many of them who generally want to know how to do a better job of managing women. And she's got a great book out there, specifically for men, called The Good Boss. It's 9 ways every manager can support women at work. You know, when it comes to a woman's day-to-day experience, one key player, as she points out, and has the most significant impact is her boss. And to truly support women in the workplace, managers, particularly men, need to step it up. This book was eye-opening. For me, I considered myself, I always thought of myself as a good boss, but even in here, there's some things, some assumptions that I was making that, you know, not out of malice, obviously, but through just lack of awareness. And that's really what the book is. It's not a finger-pointing book. It really is a self-awareness book. And particularly for men leaders like myself, there's something to be gleaned from it. I really enjoyed this book. We try to get through all 9 of the steps or the practical or advice that she highlights in the book. We ran out of time, so we kind of jammed through the last 3 pretty quick, but it's still a value-packed conversation, and the book is great. And in this conversation, we talk about how to relate to women by finding authentic connections, avoid making these assumptions about the ambition of women, particularly based on their family life choices, know what to do and not what to do when a new mother returns to work. That was a fun part of the conversation and eye-opening for me as well. And how to deal with problematic comments, you know, how to have those difficult conversations and be aware of those things that come up. It's a great book. It's an honest book. It's an authentic book. And so is Kate Eberle Walker. It was a really fun conversation. You're really going to enjoy it. The show is brought to you by my sponsor, Equity Bank. Well over 2 years, well over 50 episodes. It's been exciting watching them grow into one of the fastest banks in the Midwest. They're listed on the NASDAQ exchange. They truly understand entrepreneurship. They truly understand leadership. I know them personally. I've worked with them. I've presented at their conferences. And so if you're really looking for a new bank and your current bank looks more like a follower instead of a leader, go check out Equity Bank. You might be surprised. Equitybank.com to learn more. All right. Thanks for tuning into this episode. Subscribe, rate, and review. Like I always say, please take the time to write a review if you can. Hopefully it's 5 stars. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever your favorite podcast application is. It does wonders to keep me front and center in the business management category. And without your support, I couldn't do it. So thank you for your support. And thank you for taking the time to write a review if you could. That would just be tremendously helpful for me and the show. Check out doseofleadership.com. You can also learn more about my Dose of Leadership University, which I've just opened the doors again, looking for applications for new members to join. You can watch all the testimonials of my current members and mentors that I have in my university. And you can learn more to see if it might be something that might be a fit for you. All right, let's tune into the show with Kate Eberle Walker, the author of The Good Boss, here on Dose of Leadership. Well, Kate, welcome to Dose of Leadership. So excited to have you here.
Thank you, Richard. Happy to be here.
It's fun. I read the book, The Good Boss, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work. You know, I was talking in the pre-recording with you. You know, I've got 4 daughters. I've had many women on this show talk about this. It's a fun topic or fascinating topic for me to talk about. I've had a lot of experiences working with women. And of course, seems like I've always struggled saying the right things for my daughters, you know, to get them to navigate what it's like to work in this world. So tell me, why did you write this book? What's the purpose of the book? Why did you sit down and write this?
So I wrote the book after a couple of realizations. One was that women would come to me. They come to me often for career advice. You know, how did you get into the C-suite? How did you get where you are? And I recognized that the advice that I would give was mainly about how to maneuver through, you know, a land of men. And, you know, so much of what I thought of as, you know, the keys to success was really about, you know, how do you adapt yourself to play in this world that wasn't built by you or for you. So that was one thing. Then when I became a CEO, I realized something very different, which was it is so much easier to really change things when you're in charge. You know, so I mean, that's maybe stating the obvious, but leaders, people, you know, people in power have the power to change things. And so, you know, I wanted to, it started to change my perspective about, you know, what every CEO, HR leader, manager should take responsibility for in supporting women at work. And then I think the last realization was I started going around and asking other women who had had success, well, what do you say when women ask you for advice? Like, what's the key to your success? What's the secret? And I just over and over again heard this common refrain of, you know, I didn't really do anything in particular. I just had a really good boss. I just found a really good boss. So it was that idea of, you know, what a woman needs in the working environment today is to have a really good boss who, you know, engages in giving her opportunities and in changing the workplace to be better.
Yeah. When I originally was thinking about why you wrote this book or when I started diving into it, I think instinctively I thought, or intuitively, I thought, oh, well, this would be a great book for women. Obviously, as I started reading it, I said, this is a book for me. This isn't written for, you know, how for a woman to succeed in the business place. This is written for guys like me who find myself in leadership positions and how I can be the good boss. I mean, the title says it all, but I don't know, you know, it just kind of shows those kind of inherent biases from our culture, right? That kind of present themselves even when I picked up this book. I love how you wrote it, and it was fun. I started being said, "Oh, this is for me." As I started reading it,
I think I might literally say that in the introduction. You know, like male managers, this is for you because you do have to be fairly explicit to overcome the bias that's out there.
I remember the 16 years I worked in the corporate arena, and I worked for, I told you in pre-recording that one of the best leaders I've ever worked for was a woman. One of the worst leaders I've ever worked for was a woman. I'd like to talk about
some of those. Yeah, I want to hear about that. Both.
So the woman who was the best, when I look back on it with experience and able to digest it and think, why was she such an effective leader? It was because she did not – I mean, gender wasn't even an issue. It was so – just naturally and authentically, gender wasn't even an issue. It wasn't part of our identity, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and so every time we were working, everybody was working together. It was like all of those things were off the table. The one that was the worst boss I ever worked for, it was so front and center that it made everything so weird and uncomfortable, if that makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's as I, when I was in it, I didn't recognize it as such, but as I stepped back and I've kind of reevaluated, that's why it was that way. What do you think when you hear me say that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a lot to that idea of, you know, what dimensions do you show of yourself or present about yourself in the workplace? And I think there's, you know, gender is, you know, it's out there. It's very obvious. And it's something that, you know, people use as a way of sorting or defining, and some people do use as you know, self-defining as, you know, a big part of who they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something that I talk about in the book that I find I really admire in leaders of companies where I think they've built a culture that really kind of moves beyond gender is it's because they they create interactions and an environment at work where people show more dimensions of themselves. You know, it's there's this question of is work personal, or do you have a professional persona and a personal persona, and the two don't necessarily mix. And I am definitely on the side of, everything's personal. Everything's, we're a bunch of humans working together. That's what an organization is. And you need to show all of the sides of yourself to really be authentic, feel authentic, be happy at work. And I think that when you do that, gender, you move away from gender.
Right. You're hitting it on the head. And I think it's there was this level of authenticity, transparency, and vulnerability that emanated from the one that was the great leader. And there was always this reminding of, this is what we're doing. We're adding value. There was always this communication, this almost maniacal communication of what we're trying to accomplish and why. And so all those other stuff just, this is what we got to do. And so we're not even thinking about all that stuff that kind of makes it weird and uncomfortable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then when you don't think about it, you don't act like there are those differences there. And, I think that's how people start, treating each other more respectfully.
That's right. I think one of the things that kind of I appreciated about the book as I was reading it, I remember when I was in leadership roles and I had women that was working for me. And I remember thinking, okay, I got to find another from a mentor standpoint. I'm big in mentorship, right? And I kept thinking, I got to find somebody in this organization that'll be a great mentor for this person that works for me. And you point out explicitly, is like, look, they don't have to just be women. They can be men, right? Men can be great mentors too. I don't know why I went to that default, right? Why did I, as a man, already default that I have to find another woman to be a mentor for this high performer in my organization?
It happens. It still happens regularly. And I think part of it is, well, I think you want mentors to be relatable. You want leaders to be relatable. That's a big thing, right? I mean, for anyone to see their path and see, what their version of success is going to be, it helps a lot to be able to look up to people that you relate to. That doesn't mean that only women can mentor women. I think one thing that has, maybe continued to skew this over time is that women actually really like mentoring women. And so there's a natural matching that occurs. I've had some really great mentors that have been women, and some of the most important mentors for me were women. That I think people see that and they think that it's a good thing to replicate that. And in doing so, I think you can't forget about just the straight up law of numbers and the reality that there aren't enough powerful senior women to mentor all of the younger women that are coming up in the workforce.
I want to dive into these rules at least, and I think it'd be fun to at least touch on all nine of them. I think we have enough time. There's so many great nuggets in all of the nine rules. But before we do that, I know it's not probably fair to generalize, but I'm just curious in your take. It's fun to generalize. I don't know how healthy it is to generalize sometimes, but in general, what do you think? Particularly if you've been in the C-suite and you've been in the CEO spot, what do men and women do differently? And what do men do well and what do women do well? Again, knowing that we're all different, we're all human beings, but if you could just kind of maybe generalize in your mind, because you do have some generalizations in there or pointing out what women do better than men naturally. What do you think those are?
Yeah, so I talk in the book about multitasking I'd actually extend from that a little bit into, efficient use of time. And that's a generalization. And I do share there's two sides. You could find data to support, any side you want is something that I've learned over the course of my career. But I do think that, what I've seen in my own teams is that women are better managers of time and they're more conscious of time and how much time it will take to do things, how many things you can be doing simultaneously. And I think I make the case in the book that is often because you have to be a if you're going to be a working mom, you have to be a master of time and anticipation of time. And, you know, that skill translates really, really well to the workplace as it happens.
So that's, I agree.
That's something that I think women are really strong about. Men, I think, are stronger at self-advocating. And this I talk about in the book as well, how it struck me from the CEO seat, like, wow, the men on my team constantly ask me for stuff, you know, right. Ask me for a raise. They ask me to let them hire more people. They ask me to, you know, give them, you know, more advertising spend. I mean, always asking for things. And if I say no, that, you know, by no means will deter a lot of the most successful men from just asking again. And that behavior was very different all the way up to the highest levels of my company with the women who worked on my executive team. They were far less likely to ask in the first place and certainly to ask a second time.
Yeah. And I think men, you kind of point out, men seem more comfortable asking with partial information, like, whereas a woman will, as you point out in the book, maybe a little more analytical and wait till all of the pieces are in the fit before they ask, right? And I'm kind of generalizing there.
Yeah. And I saw this in my early years of my career. I was an investment banker. And I would, you know, work on these teams where I was watching these VPs and managing directors that were, you know, preparing the presentations and presenting them to clients. And I remember working for most of the VPs that I worked for were men, but so maybe it stood out that I did work for one woman, and she spent so much more time preparing for the client presentations. And she would ask me to go gather all of this information and run all of this backup and prepare these, you know, piles of sheets of backup that that she'd want to go through and bring to the client meeting. Whereas the male VPs that I worked for were, you know, they would wing it a lot more. Yeah. And they'd, you know, they'd swing by my desk for like 10 minutes before the big meeting and fire off a couple of directed questions. And then they'd go in and, you know, work with it. And I learned a lot from that, both about the different dynamics, but also about what worked. And back in that day, the male strategy definitely worked. They got more credit for a lot less prep time.
I agree with you. And I experienced the same thing or witnessed the same thing once I read that and started thinking back on my 16, 17 years in the corporate arena. The other thing I think, and this is where I think it's a great strength, that I think women are better at is the emotional quotient piece, and particularly in the leadership style that I gravitate towards is, you know, and I think is more needed. I think there's a huge vacuum, and I think a heck of an opportunity for all leaders to be more, you know, exercise the EQ side of themselves and become more empathetic and authentic and transparent. I think the great leaders are the ones that can really, you know, remove themselves from the situations and put themselves in the other person that they're talking to or the situation and see it. And I think women, or the women that I've seen are great leaders, are so much better at it than men.
And really, I mean, I think, yeah, it's connecting, listening, paying attention to, what the person who's talking to you is really saying, for sure. And well, especially after the, you know, year we've had through the pandemic, I mean, everything is feelings are more at the forefront. Home experiences are more at the forefront. I think, you know, back to that idea of, you know, you've got to really engage with like the full human at
right.
work.
Right.
I think in that context, having a leader who has empathy really, really matters, because, you know, what someone's going through at home, absolutely, they're definitely bringing that to work, right? There's no way that they're leaving that behind.
And I think it doesn't have to be. I think sometimes people hear that and think it has to be squishy. I think there can be great strength in that. Like a very strong, almost commanding presence with that empathetic side, to me is the home run. That's the ideal.
Yeah, it's more about acknowledgement than anything else.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
It's not that you have to be. It's certainly not being soft, and it's not. It's really, you know, making sure that everyone you're talking to knows that you understand their perspective. You understand, you know, why they're thinking what they're thinking.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Well, it's fun to generalize, and I know we can sit there. Yeah. I hate doing it, but it's fun to do. But I just kind of wanted to get that out there. But I think that going through these nine rules, it was fun to go through all of them. I mean, I saw the good and the bad side of me in each one of those, and I'm like, yeah, I've done that before. Except the first one, the caller by name. I've never called anybody sweetie. I can tell you that I've never in a meeting called anybody sweetie, honey, or a nickname. So thank God for that. To me, it just seems like that would be common sense. But it's funny that you opened up with that one, and I just didn't realize that. And I guess I have seen situations where, particularly the older, kind of an older generation, I'd seen that happen. What's that, sweetie? Or what's
There's
that?
There's a I've generational seen that. Moment, yeah. For sure. But it still happens. Happened in a meeting that I was in within the past month.
Wow.
Not to me. An older man said to another woman on my team, he called her honey.
Wow.
And, you know, it was in a joking context, you know, like a sorry, honey, but I can say, because I've talked to so many women about this, it's jarring. Even if you can process and understand on some level that it was, supposed to be a joke, it's not funny. It's not funny. It definitely leaves you with a cringing feeling.
Oh, yeah. It just seems so weird to me that would still be a thing, but
Yeah, I was, I really debated when I started writing that chapter. I didn't have that one in there because I thought that was too obvious, right?
Yeah.
But as the anecdotes kept piling on, I was like, no, it's. I guess it's not too obvious. I think it needs to be said. But that whole chapter, call her by her name, get her name right. You show respect in correctly saying someone's name. This is a big topic for women. I think more so. I mean, there's a couple reasons why it's rule number one. One is that it is, it's basic in a sense. Like, if you can't get that right, we've got, right. We've got bigger problems.
Right.
But it's also first because it's so important to women and it is so pervasive. These feelings of, repeated, calling a nickname when she didn't say, she didn't introduce herself with a nickname, spelling names wrong, mispronouncing them, not acknowledging that you changed your name, continuing to say a woman's maiden name after she gets married, all of that stuff. Like it really, really happens on an almost daily basis. If I go looking for it and just in a day of meetings, something will happen.
Wow.
Where somebody gets a name wrong.
Yeah. The name thing and spelling the names wrong. I've seen instances of that. But I'm glad that you put that in there, but the importance of that. You're right. I mean, it's like everybody likes it when they're, their name to be pronounced and spelled correctly. And that if you're not taking the time to acknowledge it, what does that even say? Right. So I agree with you on that. And it's funny that, I've had that happen to me now where someone, for whatever reason, called me by the wrong name in the beginning and I didn't correct him at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And then it happened a second time and I didn't correct. And I had to go a really long time and then finally have a very uncomfortable conversation.
That's very awkward.
So I relate to that. But yeah, I'm just surprised that we'd see that. I guess, again, as a man, I'm not looking for those things. But as I started thinking about some of the anecdotes, I'm like, yeah, there's a handful of times I was sitting in a meeting and I'm like, what? What is
that? Yeah.
But it was always someone that was really older than me, And it was
it often is. And that's where, the lesson in there for managers is it's easier for you to correct it than for her to correct it in many, many contexts. I mean, I've turned myself at this point into like the name police. I mean, even if it's, even if I'm watching, two people introduce themselves who I don't know, if I see a different name on the name tag, I'm like, is your name this or this? Because he said that and I'm not sure that's right.
Well, I think that's the takeaway again. And for all of these rules, I mean, as if you're in a leadership role and you see these things, make sure that you're kind of nipping it in the bud. And you can do it, like you said, with humor. You can do it with, you can kind of disarm the situation.
Yeah.
But maybe even pull people aside,
Exactly. It doesn't have to be in front. Yeah. It doesn't have to be confrontational.
The second one, be someone she can relate to. Certainly that makes sense. I mean, we were talking about before authenticity, where I said that leader that was so great to work with, who was a woman, she was these things. That's why she was so effective, is that everybody felt like she could relate to her, and gender wasn't even an issue. It wasn't even on the table because she was so relatable, because she was so authentic, because she was so transparent and maniacal about what we're trying to accomplish here. Right.
Yeah.
And because she was so steadfast on what we're trying to accomplish, then we didn't even worry about all the other stuff.
Yeah. She was real. Sounds like she was real. And there's trust that comes with that.
And that trust, and you talk about it in this chapter too, or this rule about the fallibility, you know, being, you know, she embraced mistakes. She didn't try to pretend that she had all the answers, you know, she goes, I don't know. And when she made a mistake, she embraced it with confidence and enthusiasm and humor most of the time.
Yeah.
And that made her real, right?
Yeah. I mean, something that I talk about in general about being a CEO, I think it is, you know, apologizing I'm often apologizing, and yeah. I mean, it needs to be genuine, but I think, you know, taking responsibility, acknowledging when something has gone wrong, I think that's a burden that, you know, you should take on as a leader. And I think it doesn't make you weaker. I think it does strengthen, you know, the trust that people can have in you if you're willing to admit when something did not go well.
Hey, we're about halfway through the conversation, but I wanted to take the time to talk about my good friends, the sponsor here of this special series at Equity Bank. Have you ever noticed that most business bankers seem to really understand just one thing? It's banking, right? And not a lot about business. It makes sense since most banks were built generations ago and now they're often run by caretakers, not business builders. Well, it's not the case here at Equity Bank. The bankers at Equity Bank didn't inherit a bank generations ago. They built one of their own. They know that building something takes expertise, vision, and hard work. And over the past decade, they've built one of the region's fastest growing banks by working side by side with customers, with entrepreneurs, with leaders in communities all throughout Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. Recently, Equity Bank was listed on the NASDAQ exchange, which gives them even greater capabilities to take on those big deals that growing businesses need to keep on growing. So if you're tired of talking to bankers who've never really ran or owned or built a business, then I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised when you talk to my friends at Equity Bank. Thanks for listening to this show. Let's get back to the conversation, this unique and special series on leadership and entrepreneurship brought to you by my friends at Equity Bank. One thing that I took from my time in the Marine Corps and I applied to this, the thing about working, and again, I came from the Marine Corps where it was so male dominated. I mean, there was no, there were no women in my squadron. There was a handful and they worked down in maintenance, but there were no women officers. There were no women pilots. It was all male dominated. And when I started working in the corporate arena, and again, my dad was great and I had a lot of examples. It wasn't uncomfortable for me to work with women, but the thing that I took from the Marine Corps that I think is critical here is there's got to be, because the challenge, I think, with men and women working together, and I've seen this in the corporate arena, is if you get too authentic, too transparent, too vulnerable, that can get into some sketchy areas, particularly with men and women. So there has to be some separateness. There has to be some what I call this fine line between fraternization and authentic and transparent and vulnerable to a point where you're not to the point where it's not fraternizing, because it can get really weird, I think, with men and women. What do you think when you hear me say that?
What about just friendship? I mean, when I wrote this chapter, when I thought about some of the best functioning workplaces and teams that I'd been a part of, there were men, there were women, we were really good friends. And I think, you know, there's a lot of complication in the workplace when, you know, people move it beyond friendship into the romantic or sexual zone. But there's a really nice connection that comes before that or apart from that, where, you know, people are just friends and they know each other and like each other and trust each other. And I think that it is a complicated balance that maybe doesn't need to be so complicated if, you know, keep it in the friend zone. Can that be a new theme?
And I think that's what I meant by the fraternism. To me, I guess that's how you put it is probably what I was meaning. In fact, I know that's what I was meaning, is that you've got to be intentional about that.
Yeah.
friendship, about that fraternization line, right?
Because yeah, well, and I think that like work friendship is different.
It is.
It's a sure. kind of friendship. And, you know, you can get into challenges if some people are, you know, if you have group, what your gender aside, if you just have, you know, groups of people who have really tight friendships and it starts to feel like decisions are being made on the side or in bubbles.
Yeah, I mean, that's, for sure.
That's something that, you know, that I'm definitely conscious of as a leader. I want to be friends with everyone, but I have to be careful not to be better friends with some
right.
others.
And it was kind of like, and that's why I took the time for the Marine Corps, like fraternization. It's like when I went out on the road, I'm with, the rule was you're not supposed to fraternize with the officers and enlisted, but you wanted to be friendly. And so like when mm-hmm. you get on and you're on the road and you're working together, you develop these bonds and these friendships. And then after a hard day work, you know, we all end up in the bar and it's usually as the officer, the senior person, hey, first round's on me. And then when things started to get, okay, it's almost to the edge where people are starting to put lampshades on their head, I better back out of there, right? Because yeah. I'm the leader. That's just the frat. That's what I mean by that. There's got to be a separateness, right?
There needs to be a separation, right? Yeah. And I remember a similar moment when I was in my first CEO role and I recognized that, I don't get to be the person that stays and has fun right, at the company holiday party.
Right.
It's exactly. time for me to go.
Yeah. And that kind of, they know my wife's names, they know my kids' names, they know maybe even certain elements of my family life that I share with them. But it gets to a point, right? At some point, I have to be separate and back out. That's all I'm trying to
do. Right. Yeah. And yeah, maybe not, you know, all of your personal problems, right?
Right.
Yeah, there's that line. But there's, you know, I remember from when I was a kid, my dad would bring me into his work. He worked at a bank, at a commercial bank, and we'd walk around and everyone knew me. You know, it's like, oh, that's Katie. I was Katie then. So it was not inappropriate nicknaming, but it was, oh, there's Katie. And then, you know, they would know what, you know, where I was in school and what was going on in my life. And I took something from that, you know, oh, you know, my dad talks about me at work. And, you know, it clearly, I think it mattered to all of these people who worked for him too.
Yeah.
That they were, you know, they were a part of his life.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, it kind of bleeds into your third rule of like, don't ask what your husband does.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of that in job interviews. I was like, oh man, I've asked that. Now, I would like to think my intent wasn't in some of these things you talk about in this rule. Like I wasn't like, oh, well, I'm going to, what her husband does is going to determine if I hire or not, or if I'm going to pay her differently because, oh, her husband's a doctor. Well, I don't have to pay her. You know what I mean? That certainly wasn't in my mind, at least explicitly. I think I was just asking in general out of curiosity. But as I read this chapter, I'm like, wow, that's really not an appropriate thing to ask in the interview.
Well, it's tough because it just so often comes with an assumption in there. I mean,
yeah.
I get that people ask me that, or sometimes I can pick up that somebody wants to ask me what my husband does and they're, you know, but maybe they know they're not supposed to ask. And you can tell sometimes when someone's curious. And, you know, with me, they're, you know, they realize like, okay, you're a CEO. You've talked about your daughters. You have two young daughters, school age daughters. So how do you do all of this? I think is where it's coming from. And so, you know, I try to cover that back in rule number two that I talk enough about. I mean, I'll proactively talk about what, you know, what my husband does and how we live and how we balance schedules and stuff like that to be open. But I think the danger is when it gets asked with an assumption of, you know, well, what it must be, you know, there must be some reason that, you know, you're able to work this way, or maybe you're not able to work so hard if your husband has a really big job too. Like there's built-in assumptions about, you know, what it means for your dedication to work, I think.
Well, yeah, you're hitting on the head. I think that for me, the takeaway, if I'm in a leadership role and I'm in this position, it might be good just to steer. I mean, I know that I was just asking just out of general curiosity and trying to get to know the person. But perception is reality. And like, if by me presenting that, the perception of the person I'm interviewing could be, oh, why, you know what I mean? It could be like, why is he asking?
Why,
you know?
Why is he asking that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely don't recommend asking it in interviews.
Yeah, I agree.
I think my recommendation is don't ask. A lot of people will offer it up over the course of getting to
right.
know them.
Sure.
And, you know, when someone offers me a nugget, I jump in with lots of questions because I'm a curious person and I generally mm-hmm. want to know more about people. But yeah, I don't ask them. I wait for something to get offered up.
Well, I can see how, you know, that's what I got from the takeaways. Like, wow, I think I was asking just because I was trying to fill up the, you know, out of my own insecurities and filling up the gap and not being prepared for the interview, to be quite honest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As the manager, you know, I'm just asking a human question, but I can see how that could be perceived the wrong way. And certainly I'm sure people have asked, there have been examples where people have asked, you know, because I want someone that's going to not have to leave and go pick up kids in daycare.
Right.
And those questions shouldn't even be in, you know, just assuming like, oh, well, she has kids. That means she's going to be a hassle for me. And, you know, that's just wrong. Right.
Yeah. Or even there's still this lingering idea. Again, I remember it back, especially in my days of banking, where a woman gets engaged. And now it's suddenly a question like, oh, will she keep working? Mm-hmm. You know, if she doesn't need to work, will she keep working? Was this dialogue that I remember hearing more openly back in my days working in finance, maybe because people are really conscious of economics and value in that context. I don't know, but it's still that still comes up. That sort of, you know, like the speculation that begins about a woman from you know, when a ring appears on the finger, so to speak. And that's there's danger in that. You know, you don't want to restrict conversations to a point where, you know, nobody's interested in the fact that a woman got engaged, which is a major life event that she might want to talk about. But it's being really conscious of not taking it to that speculation of,
yeah,
you know, what will this mean for her commitment to work?
Yeah, the takeaway for me is the life events, the major life events that we all have, we shouldn't let that be part of our decision making or change the perception of her commitment of wanting to work here, right?
Yeah.
That's good stuff. And see, the fourth one is don't sit in her chair. What do we mean by that? What is that?
Don't sit in her chair is a very, you know, literal directive first and foremost. When she's coming back from a maternity leave, don't have somebody else sitting in her chair, sitting in her office. And it happened to me when I came back from my first maternity leave. One of my male coworkers had like taken my office. He'd taken over my office. It was a little bit of a better window than his. And he just moved on in, and no one had, you know, re-cleared my office for me or prepared a space for me to come back on my first day back. And it was this, you know, really infuriating, distracting, frustrating experience on this like big day for me. I mean, I don't know if it goes without saying, but it is a big, difficult, challenging day for a woman, for a new mom to come back into the office. It doesn't mean she's not committed to work. It doesn't mean she doesn't want to come back. It's still that first day is really hard to separate from your newborn for the first time and go back in. And it just sort of, you know, twists the knife when you come back to like somebody moved all your stuff and you don't even know where you're supposed to sit anymore. You know, and yeah, people there. And so there, I mean, so there's a more figurative meaning there, which is, you know, don't, if you, just because you covered for her while she was out doesn't mean that you don't, you know, need her and need to be conscious of creating that space for her to come back to. And I mean that in, you know, as importantly, the, you know, in terms of the work and making her feel like, you know, reintegrated into work and projects and feel needed and necessary, in the workplace, but it does start with like, don't steal her desk. Don't take her stapler. This is another really funny one that like really gets strong reactions from a lot of women when I talk about this. Like what I thought was a crazy story when, you know, I would tell it like, oh, guess what happened to me when I came back from maternity leave? It turns out it's not unique at all. Some version of this seems to happen to nearly every woman.
Yeah, I've seen this maybe a half dozen times where someone's come back from maternity leave, and I've seen it, you know, it wasn't necessarily a stapler, but someone was sitting in their office and this and that. And, you know, after reading this, I'm thinking, yeah, I've seen this. And the great lesson here is that what a great opportunity. And I don't think, again, and I know the companies I worked for, it wasn't out of malice. It was just it wasn't intentional forethought and thinking, and you're missing a heck of an opportunity to kind of stand out as an organization and kind of be best in class. As if, wow, what if you just took that a little extra step and, okay, we know Kate's coming back in a week, everybody, let's make sure that we're welcoming her back. And just acknowledging, because we all have, I mean, almost everybody has kids there. I have kids, and I just, and the women that I did see come back, how difficult it was for them to drop that baby off, leave it with grandma or the daycare center. It's tough.
Yeah.
And just acknowledging that and then having everything prepared. I mean, it's not difficult. It just takes a little bit of effort, and the payoff, the return on investment would be huge. You know what I mean? To make that person
I think this is it's a really easy one to do.
I agree.
It's pretty straightforward. Doesn't cost a lot. And I think it can be a huge differentiator for a company to treat the first day back from maternity leave with, you know, a little respect, a little planning, get that space ready for her. Be, you know, ready to re-engage her in the work.
A little empathy,
because work is the best distraction when you're, you know, re-entering the world after, you know, a few months of, you know, definitely not showering every day and, you know, being up all hours of the day and night. Like the best thing is really to engage in some work. I mean, it's the really amazing feeling that starts that day is, you know, remembering that like you're a person who exists and has value, you know, outside of your new baby. And the companies that can do a good job of reintegrating women will definitely stand out.
And having a nursing room, I know that, you know, having that foresight, you know, having the place where they can nurse or at least, you know, pump is something, you know, that's not a janitor's closet or next to the bathroom. You know what I mean?
I think I go on for quite a bit about the stress of the doors that don't lock, which is problematic for everybody. I give shout out to Tim Chi, the CEO of The Knot Worldwide. I profile him in that chapter. And you know, his project setting out to design the Four Seasons of nursing rooms, which
that's nice.
It was, I mean, I, it was a beautiful, beautiful room. I wanted to, you know, move in there when I got to tour it.
That's awesome. Well, it kind of segues into the watching the clock. I mean, someone comes back, they have the kid. I've seen this, and I've had people on my team, and I had to remind my CEO, I specifically thought of a specific example of someone that worked for me, came back from maternity leave. And he just was not cognizant of the clock and just not empathetic to that you've got to pick up kids, that you've got to do this, and that putting people in awkward situations
and it's really, really hard to, you're very self-conscious about it. You don't want to be the one who has to leave, who looks less committed to work. For years I had that stress of, you know, on the one hand, I had, you know, the clock was ticking at home. You know, my childcare was gonna, you know, hit the deadline, and my child needed me there. But I'd be sitting in these meetings, and I'd look around and just realize that, you know, these are all men. Like, they all have wives who are, you know, feeling this same stress wherever they are, but it's not even occurring to them. And that's the thing. And that's where I say, you know, like a lot of the stuff in the book, I get that it's not, these things are not done with malice. It's much more often, you know,
it's just lack of awareness. It's all
managers don't realize. They don't realize what a big deal it is. And so having that, you know, again, there's always more, you know, the more power you have, the more senior you are in a company, the easier it is for you to be the one to say something. And it's generally easier to speak up on behalf of somebody else versus for yourself. And so this is one of those where if you're in one of these meetings and a woman who works for you, if she told you, she, you know, I have to leave by 6 to be home to relieve the nanny, like, it's just so much better if it's the boss who can interject and can do it. You know, sometimes it's really subtle. It's just, you know, Julie, I know you need to leave. That's okay. We'll catch up later, so that she's not sitting there, you know, tapping her toe, trying to figure out what do I do? What do I do? Do I get up? Do I say something?
Well, again, it speaks to the emotional quotient piece that I think is so needed in today's leadership. I mean, you're right. I mean, and it's great how you wrote the book. It isn't, it's just a reminder of the lack of awareness, the way it's even written and the message that's coming across as the reader. I'm like, oh, you know, you're not shaming me. You're just, hey, you know, be aware of this. You know, it could do wonders. It could pay huge dividends if you're just simply aware of this.
Yeah. And so much of it is, you know, you probably didn't even know.
Yeah.
And if you knew, you wouldn't do it, or you'd do it differently. Yeah. So that's what a lot of the book is about.
The next one, speak up so she doesn't have to. I think, you know, I think about so many situations in the military and in the corporate arena where, again, that awareness of kind of as a leader, I got to be listening to what other people are saying. So many times when I've been in that leadership, but at the end of the table, the guy running the meeting, and I'm so worried about what my next agenda item is, how I'm coming across. And what my takeaway on this is, it's like, man, you've got to start listening to the room. It's like, that is your job as the leader of that meeting or even the organization, is you've got to be listening about what's going on and stop worrying about what you're going to say, right? I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting from this. And because we've got to have the moral courage. We got to have the awareness to speak up when something happens. We need to like nip it in the bud right then in front of everybody. I'm a huge advocate of that, you know. It's stop worrying about being uncomfortable about it. We can do it with humor, like you point out here in the book, but call it out and be prepared. You are the advocate for everybody. And it's not just women, but you got to be, but I think you've got to be particularly cognizant, particularly when in these type of situations.
Yeah. And I mean, so something that chapter gets into is, you know, all of the layers within a company. And, you know, there it's one thing to, you know, call upon a male CEO to, you know, stop a bad behavior, or, you know, or say, speak up and say something about a comment, an uncomfortable comment. But, you know, I got so many interesting perspectives from men who were managers, but who were, you know, in layers in the middle, considered themselves middle management. And they're like, well, what am I supposed to do? Well, how do I know that she even wants me to call it out, was one thing that came up a lot. Or, you know, am I just gonna, you know, bring the wrath of that more senior guy down on me? And what does that mean for my career? You know, the sort of real feelings of fear and risk in doing it. And so I tried to give strategies for, you know, acknowledging that and saying, you know, I get it. Like, not, you know, not everyone is going to stand up and give a movie speech every, you know, on behalf of women every time, you know, an inappropriate comment is made. But here are a bunch of ways, find the ones that work for you. And one that I think is really, maybe undervalued is just acknowledging it to her. No, that's not the same thing as, you know, going straight at the offender or, you know, addressing something in the moment. But I can tell you it goes a long way to let her know that you acknowledge it, you don't agree with it, and to ask her what, you know, what she would like to see you do about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great tactic. Sometimes in the heat of moment, and sometimes it happens too late, because things can happen fast if you're not on your toes. And a lot of times you're not on your toes. You're thinking about something else and something happens and you're like, well, that was kind of weird or cringeworthy or whatever. And then you don't do anything about it. You know, that has happened to me. And the afterwards, I'm like, hey, I just noticed this. I just wanted to check in and see. And it did. It paid huge dividends, just even having that acknowledgement, right?
Yeah.
I think when I was mentioning that leader I worked for, the woman leader who was really great, she set the stage early in her expectations, both in the interview, and then she would always remind, she had two rules, you know, this is, you know, it's not your right to challenge me, it's your obligation. And number two, we treat everyone with respect, tolerate disrespect from no one. Those were the two simple rules. And that really set the stage, you know. And so it was easy when everybody knew that those were the two rules. It made it easy to speak up, to your point of where, well, am I going to get the wrath from her if I speak up? Well, she told me it's my obligation to challenge in a respectful manner. And then the second one is if you see someone being disrespectful, you call it out. Like, well, why do you do it, man? You know, so I thought that was good.
Yeah.
Oh, we're running out of time because you got a hard stop here. But we got the speak up, she didn't have to, what I just did. That was rule six. And seven is don't make her ask twice. Eight is be an equal opportunity asshole, which I love. And then tell her that you see her potential. Out of those three, let's just sum up those three so I make sure the listener gets a taste of all of those. What do you say about all of those three?
I think of those, being the equal opportunity asshole, really, I mean, it really connects all of them together. And and there's a lot to this one. I mean, I have, you know, taken significant career leaps under the management of some real assholes. they made me better. They helped me earn organizational respect by challenging me in front of others the same way they challenged the guys, and, you know, giving me that chance to show that I could, you know, that I could do it, show what I could do. So, I think that this is a really important one, but it comes with a lot of nuance because it can very quickly go from good to bad if you're too much of an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, and it's not really about, I'm not encouraging anybody to, you know, be terrible to people. What I'm really encouraging is honesty and equal treatment. And, you know, I think that sometimes I've been in experiences where I can feel that, that men are being a little more careful around me. Maybe they don't want to be as critical. They don't want to hurt my feelings. You know, I've felt that throughout my career, and it's it doesn't help me get better, but it doesn't help the perception of me that others have. You know, it sort of feeds into this idea that a woman is weaker. So, you know, there's so much value in, you know, being challenging and asking tough questions, you know, holding people up to high standards in front of an audience in a company. I mean, these are things that, you know, a lot of women really want and really will thrive if they're given the chance.
Yeah, that's my takeaway from, you're right. It's not that I have to be an asshole to be, but right. We've all worked for jerk bosses and I've seen it, but you're right. It's like this jerk boss may yell at me, may give me, you know, may treat, well, I don't want her to cry, so I'm going to be a little different. Just know, if you're going to be just,
if that's who you are,
if that's who
right?
You
and
are,
the rest of the book is really, I mean, I'm, you know, saying again and again in different ways, like be authentic, be real, be yourself. And so if that's who you are, okay, just, you know, just be that way to everybody.
And you're right. And you're going to respect me. If you're working for me, and if I'm challenging to Joe Schmo over here, I'm going to be equally challenging to you. And if I'm calling him out in the meeting, whatever. I mean, I agree with you. I think there's some value of making things a little uncomfortable. I think that's a huge leadership.
Yeah.
I think I'm a big proponent of leaders making things a little uncomfortable, not for the sake of ego or for making someone look stupid, but to push you out of your comfort zone and push you into the growth zone and push you into making decisions and doing what's right, right? And to push you even further. And that's all you're asking people to do. If I'm going to do it for Joe, I'm going to do it for Sally Sue, right? And so that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nothing wrong with a little hard work, right?
Right.
With challenging people. I do think it feeds into the final rule in the book, which is tell her that you see her potential because, you know, I think that the most confidence building compliments also come from these tough bosses. You know, when you know that you're working for someone who is calling it like it is and is direct and is honest, you know, getting people like that to remember to, you know, take the time to compliment the good pieces and to say what they do admire and what they do see in somebody is tremendously valuable in building confidence.
Great book, Kate, The Good Boss, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work. We just scratched the surface. I highly recommend everybody go get it, particularly men. I got a lot out of it, you know, and I consider myself an equal opportunity employer and offender. So I think that, you know, that I learned a lot from it, you know. Great job, Kate. How can people connect with you and learn more about you?
Go to my website, kateeberlywalker.com. Or you can pre-order the book on Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, anywhere books are sold. You can look up The Good Boss and find the book.
I'll have links to all this in the show notes. Kate, thanks for coming on the show. So proud to have you in the Dose of Leadership tribe. I look forward to staying in touch and maybe having you back.
Thank you so much. Thank you for reading the book. Thank you for learning from its messages. And thanks for engaging in the work of supporting women.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kate. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into the show. I hope you got some value out of this episode. If you did, please do me a huge favor. Tell somebody about this show. Tell your spouse, tell your kids, tell your coworkers. Let them know about the value that Dose of Leadership brings to your world. Go to doseofleadership.com. You can learn more about my services. If you're looking for somebody to speak, teach, or coach about leadership, I'm your guy. I'm known for my ability to transform individuals and organizations, teaching them the concepts of creating a culture of decentralized leadership. I do think that is the secret sauce to facing all the challenges that we face today. Thanks so much for tuning into the show. I look forward to the next time we're together. And until the meantime, make it a great one.